As I introduce my next guest, I can't really get that Paul Kelly song out of my mind, From Little Things, Big Things Grow. As Margaret Heffernan is talking about the big impact of small changes in the workplace, and of course that could include governments as well. Saturday Extra listeners may remember Margaret Heffernan, who was on the program early last year, talking about how much competition we have in our lives and how detrimental it can actually be, which prompted several of you to hit your computers and email us. But in this new research, she's concentrating on the culture of workplaces and how even a scheduled coffee break can make a huge difference in work creativity. Let me remind you of Margaret's credentials. She went from producing BBC documentaries to running a trade association to buying and selling internet companies and now to advising senior executives. She's also authored a number of well-received books. Willful Blindness, at the Financial Times credited as one of the best business books of the decade, and A Bigger Prize, and that's the one we spoke to her about last year. This book now, Beyond Measure, The Big Impact of Small Changes, is much smaller in size. It's part of the new TED Books series, and they're quite a different shape altogether. But they're certainly not small in ideas. Margaret joins me from the UK. Welcome back to Saturday Extra.
Well, it's nice of you to invite me back. Thanks, Geraldine.
Before we get into the coffee break idea, how does it make a workplace more efficient to have a routine step outside your normal duties?
Well, as you're probably aware, most businesses on the planet are very obsessed these days about innovation, but they're very unclear as to where that innovation comes from. And, you know, one of the things I think we have to be clear about is that for all that we can automate lots of parts of work, you know, the truth is companies don't have ideas, only people do. And really what provokes people to do their best thinking, their most creative thinking, is the interactions between them. But if you organize people in such a way that those interactions are either very transactional or very minimized in the interests of so-called efficiency, then the kind of social energy that occurs between people and fuels ideas simply will not develop. So in some ways, my little book is a big kind of cry to restore the human element of business, because that's where all creativity comes from.
Yes, you say the Swedes have a word for it, fika, I think it is, a moment when everyone, and I think this is the point you make about this everyone gathering for a coffee break, it flattens the workplace and people talk about work and non-work.
That's right. So one of the things that's really interesting is there are a number of examples where when people coordinated their coffee breaks, so they were together, they weren't just taking them all in isolation. One thing that happens is that knowledge about what's going on in the company, problems that are need solutions within the company, this kind of information flows very much faster. And it's from that social connectedness and from that information flow that ideas emerge. And that's true both by coordinating things like coffee breaks. It's also true, for example, in some of the most productive science labs that I studied, when people are willing to devote time to things that aren't just science, that you need to create a culture of trust and openness for people to share ideas, which is how you get great ideas, which started off often is quite small ideas.
Mm. I notice you say some companies now ban coffee cups at desks, and not because of the computers to protect them, but to ensure that people hang out together around the coffee machine or whatever it is that you have.
That's right. So some companies ban coffee cups at desks. Some people ban lunch at desks and have built lunchrooms. Some companies even provide free lunch so that people have a reason, an excuse, if you like, to hang out together, because they recognize that while it may look like downtime, it's actually fantastically productive for people to spend time together, to share ideas and thoughts about what might make their job or the business more productive.
Look, can I just say, at RN a couple of years back, when we did this big refit in Sydney, a big kitchen was created, a big kitchen area with this exact same idea. But I noticed there's still a lot of people eating at their desks or going out to eat. So to create this culture that you're describing, you actually had to be rather dogmatic about it, don't you?
Well, I think you have to be dogmatic and you have to kind of let people understand that this may look like it's really soft and squishy, but actually it's pretty essential to the way that the business functions. I think also, you know, I'm not saying people have to spend every minute of every working day together. Obviously, there are times you do want to leave the office to clear your head, which is pretty productive also. But I think the fundamental issue here is that what makes companies really resilient, robust, creative, productive is what's happening between people. It's the relationships between people, which I call and social capital. And there are many instances in which you can say that see that companies with high degrees of social capital, high degrees of trust and reciprocity, that these companies are more productive, more efficient, and more creative than companies that think it's efficient to schedule individuals like widgets so that they never really touch each other.
Yeah, and these changes are about making a just culture, which I was quite surprised, I have to be honest, when I read that, because that was a heavily value-laden term, I thought. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, a just culture isn't my term. It's a term that comes out of the aviation industry. And in the 70s, after a particularly bad plane crash that investigation showed had been caused by lots of small things that many people knew were wrong, the aviation industry tried to figure out a process and a culture that would allow people more easily, quickly, and openly to share their concerns. Because their feeling was everybody in the business is part of an early warning system, and the more quickly we get this information to the surface, the safer the industry will be. They called it a just culture because it works from the presumption that people come into work to do a good job, not a bad job, and that you want a culture of fairness and openness really to capture the value of every single person. And I think it's really interesting because the aviation industry itself says that this is one reason why aviation has become steadily safer over the years and why it is now the safest form of transport on the planet. Now, it's interesting because I wanted to call the book Just Culture, and the publishers didn't because they didn't like the word just, which I still haven't quite figured out, I'll be honest.
Well, maybe they think it sounds worthy and as if you're on a sort of a mission.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I am actually on a mission, which is I think that every company I've ever worked in, any company I've run, every company I've ever visited, I think holds more capacity, talent, energy, innovation than is being captured. And we need to think really hard about how we create an environment in which people really generously bring forward all their thoughts, ideas, observations, and feel that it's safe and fair to share those.
Let me tell the listeners who I'm talking to. Margaret Heffernan is our guest, an entrepreneur, chief executive, author, and a real thinker. And we're talking about how small changes can make big impacts in the workplace. And you're here on RN on Saturday Extra. So let's get to another aspect, which is your doing away with hierarchy. And you give a little example that everyone is included in some of the companies you've observed, for instance, inviting the cleaners into a work meeting, which is not easy to actually imagine, well, A, whether they'd want to be there, and dare I say, and maybe I'm revealing my own prejudices, what would they have to contribute?
Well, of course, it depends hugely on the business. But if you're trying to gauge, for example, what a public reaction to something might be, frankly, a cleaner's perspective is as good as anybody else's. The person who used to do this was Jim Henson, who, you know, is famous for inventing the Muppets. So obviously, you know, how a cleaner responds, how an executive responds, how a receptionist responds, you know, these are all valid data points.
I can see exactly that they've got a lot, you know, their own perception of the world to bring, which is valuable. But I have seen meetings which become too big with this type of approach in mind. And I think they become unwieldy and often, frankly, counterproductive.
Well, I think you're absolutely right that, you know, some meetings are just too big to be productive. But I think the point about hierarchy is this, that hierarchies block both accountability and creativity. Why? Well, creativity, people often have ideas. I encounter this all the time, but they think, they're not permissible.
Mm.
They're afraid of how do I get it through the hierarchy. And they think, well, if it were a good idea, you know, the 17 layers of brilliant people above me would have come up with it. Equally, with accountability, when people see something going wrong, they often think, they look at the hierarchy above them and they think, well, if this were a serious problem, somebody, they think, looking up, somebody would have done something. So hierarchies both trap information and they trap feelings of responsibility, because there's always somebody above me that I can think, actually, I don't want to say this. I'm sure someone up there will if it matters.
Look, I've just got to cut through because you have a wonderful example of Arup, one of the world's most successful architectural engineering firms, did the Bird's Nest Stadium in Beijing, the Cheese Grater in London, and so on. And you tell me that in its 69 years, the company's never lost money, borrowed or shrunk, and people from within the firm believe that much of its success has depended on minimizing hierarchy.
Right, and that's very much about what they call creating a culture of helpfulness, so that if I have a project and I'm stuck, then it's very easy for me to reach out and ask for help because I don't know where the expertise might be hidden. And the example that I think is really interesting in that case was an engineer working on the equestrian center for the Beijing Olympics who had to try to figure out when you have, you know, 2,500 highly strung, super expensive horses getting off long-haul flights, what quantity of waste do you have to allow for? Now, that's the kind of problem you definitely don't want to get wrong, but it's also not the sort of thing that's taught in engineering schools. So you could, if you were felt trapped by your hierarchy, you could sit there for months, you know, interviewing vets and working out spreadsheets. At Arup, in fact, what happened is the engineer just asked around, did anybody know about this? And discovered that one of his colleagues had built the Jockey Club in New York. So something that could have taken months was solved in less than 24 hours. That's the power of being able to reach easily and freely across hierarchies.
Look, you have a lovely line here. Once you work from the simple assumption that everyone counts, everyone contributes more. And it doesn't mean, however, that everyone does everything. Knowledge does matter, expertise matters, but leadership itself is fluid. That's very provocative.
Well, I think, you know, what we've seen in business failures around the world is not that there was a lack of information or expertise, but that people didn't feel accountable. It's very easy within a hierarchy to look around you and say, well, all these people are here, maybe they'll do something. Maybe they'll see the problem or they'll see the opportunity. But what we can see, you know, from multiple business failures is that because everybody could, nobody does. And I think that's the fundamental cultural shift that we have to consider and take very, very seriously. How do you move from a situation where nobody does take accountability to one where everybody does feel responsible? And the great quality, you know, guru Deming put this really brilliantly. He said, a great productive working culture is one where nobody has to ask permission to take responsibility.
Look, final question in terms of small things. Admitting mistakes spend a bit of time on can be incredibly difficult to do in workplaces. And you talk about the need to do this, particularly with surgeons, where mistakes really can be life and death. But there are other organisations which you quote, where, for instance, a folder is established in the office where mistakes are written down and any new employees read this as part of their induction process, which is a fascinating thought.
Well, it's really interesting, and it reminds me of a chairman I once worked with who was the lead investor in my business, and he said to me, Margaret, I don't really mind if you make mistakes, but I am going to mind if you make the same mistake twice because it'll show that you weren't learning and paying attention. And I think the truth is that, you know, all of us being human will make mistakes, but as long as we acknowledge them and really dig deep into them to gain all the learning we can, then we'll make them again. And I think one of the fundamental jobs of leadership is to create an environment in which it's easy to acknowledge mistakes so that everybody can learn from them, because that's frankly how organizations get smarter faster.
Yes, I once sat on a board where the chief executive did encourage people to bring their dilemmas, their unsolved problems, very much to the board table. I tell you, I thought it was absolutely brilliant. Margaret, thank you very much indeed for joining us again.
Well, thank you, Geraldine. It was a pleasure.
And Margaret Heffernan, her latest book is Beyond Measure, and it certainly won't threaten the forest. It's a gorgeous little thing, The Big Impact of Small Changes, and it's published by Simon & Schuster.